Would you like for us to post information about your congregation on the Find a Church page of our website? We'll add your church when it becomes part of the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues Etc. Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. to your church's mission or advertising budget. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 at issuesetc.org. Click support and publicize your congregation to the world.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us for the remainder of this hour to talk about liberal tolerance. It's most certainly liberal, maybe not in the classical sense of the word, but in the popular sense of the word. But is it tolerance? This viewpoint that on the face of it is just so broad-minded, so open-minded, so willing to live and let live. Dr. Frank Beckwith joins us to talk about liberal tolerance and to help us take it apart on this Tuesday afternoon, November the 22nd. He's professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, author of several books, including Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft. He's also written an article for the Christian Research Journal titled Deconstructing Liberal Tolerance. Dr. Beckwith, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me.
You say that it is a religious viewpoint in itself, especially when it comes to its lack of tolerance for other religions, that it has totalitarian impulses, a partisan, these are your words, a partisan philosophical perspective.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like it is what it purports to be.
Well, that's right. I mean, let me, you know, say, before I provided some examples for the audience. There's nothing in principle wrong with tolerance. That is, there's nothing wrong with, let's say, living in a free society where, because we live in a free society, people are bound to disagree on a variety of issues. That in itself actually makes sense in terms of tolerance if we can learn from other people. That is, tolerance is a virtue because I could be corrected. Or I can correct somebody else. I can learn something, right? The problem, though, today is that tolerance is used in a way that I don't think actually leads to or establishes that. For instance, when soon after the state of Massachusetts allowed gay marriage, soon after that, the state required that Catholic Charities and any other charitable organization that was in the adoption business could not restrict adopting children or adoptee children to families that were married heterosexuals. And the argument was, well, it's now legal gay marriage, and therefore everyone must honor it. But according to liberal tolerance, as it should be applied, you should have heard something like this. We understand that the Catholic Church or any other Christian group who opposes gay marriage does so because it's a reasonable position that thoughtful people from these theological traditions accept. Therefore, we will not, as the state, coerce people to have to agree with what they in good conscience cannot believe in. No, what we had was everyone must agree. And so you find this kind of odd tactic. That is, it begins with, let's listen to other people, understand where they're coming from, and be tolerant. That sounds reasonable. But then what happens is when certain positions become dominant or powerful, then all of a sudden the tolerance card is no longer played. What's played is a kind of requirement that everyone agree that one position is correct. And usually the disagreement is penalized in fashions that are pretty punitive. Not only do you have the case of Catholic Charities in Massachusetts, you have the situations throughout the United States where individuals who have, because of theological and deeply important reasons of conscience, cannot agree. And yet we have, in the name of liberal tolerance, coercion.
So what is its philosophical foundation? I know that what it claims to be, but if you broke it down philosophically, what are its basic assumptions, worldview, if you will?
I think one assumption is that that individuals who hold theological points of view cannot in principle be correct. So, for instance, I had this phenomenon in class. One of my students was complaining that a friend who she was witnessing to — I teach at a Christian university, Baylor, so we actually talk about things like sharing your faith in the classroom — and one of them said, "Well, my friend said that I was intolerant because I believed I was right, and I thought the person I was speaking to was wrong." And she asked me, "How could I, you know, help me to deal with this?" And I said, "Well, ask her whether she thinks you're wrong in thinking that way." And that really led to a wonderful conversation in the class where I told the student, "Look, she believes you're wrong, and you believe she's wrong. At the end of the day, you have two opposing positions on the nature of a theological belief. But what she wants to tell you is that you have no right to act as if your belief is true, whereas she has a right to act as if all theological beliefs are mistaken, except for her understanding of theological beliefs." So it turns out there's a kind of bait and switch going on. It starts out with, "Let's listen to each other because we disagree and we can learn." Fine. But then it shifted to, actually, what we really believe is that people who believe theological truths about God, Christ, Bible, etc., can never in principle be correct. And it turns out to be a kind of dogma then, the very sort of thing that liberal tolerance promised it wasn't going to do.
Do the adherents to this, and there are many of the casual adherents out there, you run into them all the time, do they know that they are basically playing with a double standard?
I don't think they do. I think it has largely to do with the fact that the popular culture has assimilated this understanding, and most people don't really think about it. My friend Greg Kokel, with whom I co-authored a book on relativism several years ago, tells the story of a fellow who he was sharing his faith with, and the guy said something along the lines of, "Well, you know, Greg, you shouldn't judge other people as, you know." And Greg said, "Well, aren't you doing that to me? Yeah, you're saying that I ought not to assert my beliefs as true." And the guy kind of was fumbling around, and he just said, "There's no way I can say it without sounding ridiculous." And Greg said, "It's because it is ridiculous.
It feels good. It feels
right,
but it is so logically inconsistent."
Yeah, one of the things I tell this to my students at Baylor, I say, you know, I think it's best whenever we have a conversation, or whether you have a conversation with folks who hold this view, just to be candid and say, "Look, let's lay our cards on the table. Let's admit at the beginning that we think each person, the other guy, is wrong, and then we can talk." But as long as the conversation reduces to who is more virtuous, you're never going to have a conversation. And in many ways, liberal tolerance, for all its talk about wanting to allow people to express their views freely, actually is a kind of conversation stopper.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if I say, for example, I think I'm right, let's say about, I believe Christianity is true, that Christ is the Messiah, and so forth, and somebody accuses me of being intolerant to believing that, the person is essentially saying, since intolerance is an immoral position to practice, or an immoral way to live one's life, you should be silent from now on. That is, they are essentially saying to me, "Shut up." In that sense, it's a conversation stopper. On the other hand, if they said, "You know, I don't agree with you about Christianity or about Jesus, but because I'm a tolerant person, I'd like to hear you out, and then maybe we can talk." Now, that's true tolerance. That's true tolerance, and that's not a conversation stopper.
But see, that says – that's a whole different philosophical foundation. That is a tolerance built upon the assumption, the mutual assumption, that there is truth, that there is falsehood, right?
That's right. That's right. There's a kind of built-in relativism with what I've described as liberal tolerance.
Now, you also describe a tactic, and it is amazing to me how successful this tactic is by those who purport to be liberally tolerant. You say it's a passive-aggressive tyranny. What do you mean by that? Give us an example.
It's passive aggressive in the sense that it sounds like it sounds passive. That is, somebody is in fact sounding like they are really open to alternative points of view. But what they really are suggesting is that your point of view ought not to be spoken. For example, supposing let's look at the case again. I think I give an example in the article an acceptance speech by. I forget her name, the actress.
Ellen DeGeneres.
Ellen DeGeneres, my lord. That was a senior moment. Ellen DeGeneres. But I'm going to give a different example. And it's once against the gay marriage example. If somebody says, let's say, we ought to allow same-sex marriage because it'll allow people to be able to get married who otherwise wouldn't. It's not going to hurt you. It's not going to harm your life or your marriage, so why would you be against it? But you start thinking about, though, what exactly marriage entails for the rest of society and culture and our laws, and it actually does affect us. So, for instance, the case of the photographer in New Mexico, who, because she was a Christian and had moral objections to any sort of same-sex relationship that was romantic, refused to be a photographer. She's a photographer. She did not accept as a client a couple that wanted her to photograph the commitment ceremony. She was subsequently fined over $6,000 by the local Human Rights Council. Now, there's a case where you think, wait a second, we were told that this isn't going to affect people. In fact, it does affect people. And so it sounds like the person is offering a very open position that's not narrow, that it's going to expand the number of people who have rights and liberties. But what it does, it simply readjusts who gets liberties.
Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. We're talking about liberal tolerance. It's Tuesday afternoon, November the 22nd.
There ain't no bad guy. There's only you and me, and we just disagree.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most radio talk shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you to pay for the production, salary, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, asking you to consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. The address? LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend on you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen On Demand page and click Share This.
Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
And all is relative, relative. Everything is relative. Yes, it is.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about liberal tolerance. Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. He's professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. author of several books, including Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, and he's also written an article for the Christian Research Journal titled Deconstructing Liberal Tolerance. You can read this article under the Listen on Demand page at our website, issuesetc.org. I've found something, and this is only in casual conversation, but it's remarkable how often I've run across it, a very strange epistemology working in the mind that is now kind of addled by relativism. And it goes something like this, if you're, regardless of the subject you're discussing, but in my case, it's usually theology. Well, I can find a lot of people who would disagree with you. That's the argument. Therefore, the conclusion is made, you can't be right. Because so many people have so many different opinions. What is going on here?
That's right. That's a great example. Our common friend Hadley Arkus, I know he's been on your show before, has his retort is, well, at that point I can announce my disagreement with the principle that whenever people disagree, nobody's right. That is, you know, the person assumes the principle that whenever people disagree, nobody's right, or you can never know you're right. Of course, if that's the case, then if you disagree with that principle, then you can reject that principle on the same grounds. It's self-refuting. It's a silly way to reason. But it also, what it also does is another kind of argument stopper, because at that point, what the person is really saying, I'm not going to talk anymore about this. I'm not going to engage the conversation. I'm not going to try to figure out who's got the better arguments. People just disagree, and I withhold judgment. And now, in some cases, there's nothing wrong with withholding judgment. But as a sort of way to go through life, it really actually shuts you off from open-mindedness, doesn't make it easier.
Is there another double standard at work here? And I'll give you an example, and you tell me how this one works. The very prominent cases recently in the news, Herman Cain, a Republican presidential candidate, has been accused of certain sexual improprieties. He's been accused, okay? Not long ago, it was President Bill Clinton who was accused of similar sexual impropriety, some of them a bit worse in the eyes of the law. Now, someone might say, look, I can hold Herman Cain accountable for his alleged improprieties because he's a family values guy. He claims to have a moral center. Bill Clinton never really claimed to have a moral center, and he wasn't a big proponent of family values. I can't hold him accountable for that. What's going on?
Well, I think the person assumes that the wrongness of adultery is contingent upon whether somebody believes adultery is wrong. That's sort of silly. I mean, it would be like asking burglars to write property law. I mean, either adultery is wrong or it's not. Now, you know, there is a sense in which people are kind of gleeful, and this is actually a very bad trait in our politics, which often I think gets ignored, is the wrongness in being happy about somebody falling. I mean, there is something pernicious about that. You find this years ago when the head of the Ted Haggard, the head of the National Association of Evangelicals, had a major indiscretion, a sexual one, and there was sort of glee out there. And I just thought, you know, even though I think what he did was clearly wrong and immoral, and I think he did the right thing in resigning his post. But, you know, the idea that somehow there are people out there who actually enjoy the fact that other people morally fail. To compare, you know, Clinton and Cain, if adultery is wrong, then it really shouldn't matter who you know, whether one in fact believes it or not. We wouldn't say, for example, that a burglar is worse off morally if he believes burglary is wrong, but the sociopathic burglar, well, he's not as bad. I mean, either it's wrong or it's not, and whether one's subjective reaction to it or thought of it shouldn't be relevant. There is, of course, you know, if people go around saying that they're morally good people and it turns out they're not, I mean, that in itself is a sin. It's a sin of hypocrisy. But it doesn't have any bearing on whether you can make a judgment about the act.
Let's talk with Joe, who's listening in St. Louis. Joe, thanks for waiting on the line.
Hi, Todd. A couple things. Number one, the liberal inability to allow for a point of view other than its own is one of the most frightening things I think I see. Number two, do you ever run into people, does your guest run into people who might have a degree of fear in the sense that if they allow for any discussion that they'll, that they're afraid they'll be persuaded away of the view that they like holding on to? Number three, if he'd care to speculate as to what degree, if any, we will see the legislating away of dissent in our country.
Great questions.
Oh, great. Let me go for the second one and then the third. His second point, I think that there's – I don't think it's a fear of contrary arguments. I think it's a fear of that if you in at all permit or admit that the other side has a point and concede that the point is legitimate, people may listen to those arguments and be persuaded. So actually, I think it's a type of strategy. That is, you see this in the gay marriage debate, and I know I've used it several times, but it's the best, I think, the best contemporary example. You have this attempt to marginalize and to make disreputable the view that marriage is ought to be only between one man and one woman. Instead of engaging the argument, it's simply this kind of anyone who believes that's got to be a bigot and dismiss it out of hand. Because if you think about it, if let's supposing you know supporters of gay marriage said, and there are those by the way who do say this, who I think are well-meaning people who I think are mistaken. Imagine if most of them, in fact, said something like this. You know, I can see why somebody believes that marriage is between a man and a woman, and I don't think people who hold that view are bigoted or irrational. I just think they're wrong. Let's have a public conversation. If they said that, they would surely lose. Because that means that people would be able to listen to both sides. At least I'm confident in the arguments for my position. So I do think the caller is partly right that there is a kind of fear, but I think it's I don't think it's merely visceral. I think it's strategic.
What about his question regarding whether or not you could foresee in our body politic a legislating away dissent in Parliament?
I don't think you'll ever see legislating away dissent because you have too many, I think, at least in most parts of the United States, most Americans, even those Americans that are maybe not churchgoers or have this, you know, it's in our cultural DNA to support religious liberty. I wouldn't be surprised if the courts did something. And, you know, the thing about legislating away that you may see it more on the federal level on these, especially we see it, I think, in the Obamacare application, or in Obamacare, the application of conscience clause, certain way of thinking of the conscience protection that actually really doesn't protect. And I think that's where you're going to see it. You're never going to – I don't think you're going to see, you know, the government taking over churches or anything of that sort or doing anything overt. It's going to be on those cultural issues on which Christian believers and also some non-Christians as well and secularists disagree. So it'll be abortion, gay marriage, euthanasia. Those are the issues. And on those questions – when it comes to tolerance, liberalism will not tolerate dissent. And as long as you remain in your church and sit and not say anything, you'll be fine. But if you, let's say, are a person that wants to, who believes in the common good and believes that that individual Christians ought to follow their conscience, and you speak publicly on it, you will be attacked. And I have no doubt of I've been on the receiving end myself.
Folks, you can find out about Dr. Frank Beckwith's latest book called Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Frank Beckwith is a professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University, and he's also written an article for the Christian Research Journal titled Deconstructing Liberal Tolerance. Thanks for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.
As we approach the end of another calendar year, it's getting close, folks. Please help support Issues Etc. Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian by making a year-end tax-deductible gift. Any size gift is deeply appreciated. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also make a donation by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. That's LPR Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And we thank you always for your gifts and for thinking of us at the end of the year. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Pastor Peter Bender about the fourth petition of the Lord's Prayer. That's Give Us This Day Our Daily Bread. Thursday on the program, we'll discuss John the Baptist. Dr. Jeff Gibbs of Concordia Seminary will be our guest. Friday, we'll have Pastor Bill Swirla teach us about the season of Advent, a fascinating conversation in store for you there. And then Monday, we'll conclude our review of Joel Osteen's book, Every Day of Friday. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller will be our guest. God has given us our reason and senses. And Christians of all people cannot fall for what is the nonsense of any kind of relativism, be it moral, ethical, theological, religious. We can't fall for it. He has given us our reason and senses. Let's use them. We have the mind of Christ, and we're smarter than this. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.